Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children and youth at risk. The California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected, on the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, we meet a young spoken word artist who finds poetry in pesticides, mariachi music, and growing up as a young Latina in a farm worker town.
My tongue, a formation of the stardust of my heritage, an intertwined galaxy of rolled R's and the Pledge of Allegiance.
And we hear the story behind a famous song about one of California's worst plane crashes. Most of the dead were buried in a mass grave, their names unknown. Plus a conversation between two public school teachers with very different political perspectives, trying to figure out how to talk politics with their students in these tense times.
Every day I have a student comes in and they ask a question about something going on in the headlines. What does this mean? How do I find out more about that? And then it leads to another question and another question. And that's education.
I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. Your state, your stories.
Crops are all in, the peaches are rotting, the oranges are piled in their creosote dung. They're flying.
Arlo Guthrie singing his dad Woody's famous ballad, Deportee, about one of the worst airplane disasters in California history, which killed 32 passengers in Los Gatos Canyon, near the Central Valley town of Coalinga in 1948. The dead included 28 Mexican farm workers in the process of being deported by the U.S. government. Woody Guthrie was outraged that newspaper accounts of the crash omitted the names of the Mexican passengers, just calling them deportees. So he gave symbolic names to the dead.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita, adios. Mi amigos, Jesus y Maria, you won't have a name when you ride the big airplane, and all they will call you will be deportees.
For seven decades, the names of those deportees were anonymous. They were buried in a mass grave in Fresno, until author and poet Tim Z. Hernandez made it his mission to figure out who they were, interviewing families and unearthing records in both Mexico and the United States. His new book, All They Will Call You, explores that journey, and he joins us now from our studio in Fresno. Tell us a little bit about what got you interested in the story of the Mexican deportees who died in that plane crash so many years ago.
Oh, you know, I'm the son of migrant farm workers, my grandfather, my parents, and I'm an author who likes to write about the Valley's history here in the San Joaquin Valley. So all those things kind of lined up for me to pay attention when it came onto my radar.
So many of the stories that you tell in this book involve such intimate details. I mean, we get a real sense of who these people were. You interviewed one woman, I would guess she's now close to 80 years old, who was 10 when her dad, Ramon Paredes Gonzalez, died in the crash. And he used to cross back and forth to work in the U.S. And every time he would return, he sang her a song.
Sí, porque me ves borracho, mañana ya no me ves.
She started to say the lyrics, and then her son Jaime encouraged her and said, you know, sing it for him, Mom. And so that was her singing that song from her memory.
Your book doesn't just include the stories of the Mexican deportees, but also witnesses to the crash, the pilot, the stewardess, the immigration agent who was accompanying the deportees. They were all part of this drama.
Omissions are wrong. You know, erasure is wrong. No matter what, you know, what your background is or what nationality you are. And so what I wanted to do was utilize this story for its full potential. And in that, you know, let's talk about everybody that this affected, not just, you know, obviously the passengers of the airplane, but also the pilot and the stewardess who were a brand new family who were just on the verge of having their first child together. And they were both killed, and their sisters at home who mourned them as well and grieved as much as the Gaston family who owned the ranch property, who their children saw this airplane and saw people falling out of the sky. Later on, the song, Martin Hoffman, who made the melody, who turned Woody's words into a melody, and Pete Seeger. And, you know, this one incident had such a ripple effect across borders and, you know, just various people and various lives. And I wanted to have that here on full display.
You helped get a headstone with some of the names you were able to research on that mass grave for the deportees back in 2013. And people all over the San Joaquin Valley helped raise money for that effort to help make those names visible. You have a recording of some students in the farmworker town of Dinuba who raised money for the headstone, selling cupcakes on the sidewalk. And you asked them to say presente as you read those names of the dead out loud.
Santiago Garcia Elizondo. Rosario Padilla Estrada.
It's an invocation of their spirit and that they had once existed, that these people existed and in fact are still present with us today.
You collaborated with Fresno musician Lance Canales, who did an unusual arrangement of the song Deportee, and it includes you whispering and saying the names that were missing from the original song.
They took all the money he made in his life. My brothers and sisters come work in the fruit tree. They rode the big truck till they took down and died.
When we first rehearsed for the first time here in Fresno, he showed me his version of the song, and it blew me away because I realized that this is not, you know, the same version we've heard for the last 50 years. This is actually a new, updated Lance Canales, the son of migrant farm workers, taking ownership of this incident also in a very personal way.
So many musicians have recorded the song over the years. Pete Seeger, Dolly Parton, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan. What's your favorite version?
My favorite is actually Sweet Honey in the Rock.
It's 600 miles to that Mexican border. They drive us like outlaws, like rustless like these.
What relevance do you think the song Deportee and the stories of those deportees from 70 years ago has for us now in this political climate?
Back then, they referred to the Mexican passengers as simply as deportees. Today, we hear other words being used, you know, illegal or alien and things like that. And all those kind of abstractions are meant to do is to erase the face of the people we're talking about, erase the story, erase the history of these folks. And so, you know, I feel like being able to look back at this incident using that word deportee and then actually sort of opening that up and unpacking that and showing the reader who these folks were and how, and raising that up, honoring the Mexican passengers in the same way we honor also the pilots and the stewardess and the World War II heroes. And in this book, I'm trying to honor all of them in a way that says, listen, you know, side by side, when looked at, we have much more in common than we do differences. And certainly this airplane that crashed becomes a kind of almost an analogy for, you know, hey, listen, we're all in this ship together, hurling toward a common fate.
Tim Z. Hernandez, thank you so much for joining us on the California Report.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Z. Hernandez is the winner of the American Book Award for Poetry, and he's the author of the new book, All They Will Call You, detailing the lives of 28 Mexican deportees who died in a plane wreck at Los Gatos Canyon and inspired Woody Guthrie's famous folk song. And now it's time for another in our series, Start the Conversation, where we bring together Californians from different backgrounds and perspectives to talk about their political differences, but also try and figure out common ground. For high school teachers like Brandon Johnson and Isidro Valenzuela, the latest presidential election and its aftermath have brought many more questions than usual from their students. The two teachers answer those questions from different political perspectives. Isidro is liberal and supported Sanders, though he lives in the politically conservative Central Valley. Brandon is a former Marine who identifies as conservative. He's part of a small minority in the Bay Area that voted for President Trump.
Yes, I am Brandon Johnson. I teach at Skyline High School. I teach social studies and Spanish.
My name is Isidro Valenzuela, and I teach at Fresno High School, and I teach International Baccalaureate History as well as Race and Social Justice.
Teaching in Oakland, a large percentage of my students are first and second generation immigrants from all over the world, and they do heroic things with big goals and big dreams, and we send them off to major universities. When you think about especially the individual kids, for me, and many of my colleagues, it's like brings tears to your eyes, you know, what they overcome and they still stay. And I think that's what makes me proud as an American. What my vision of America is not making excuses, just setting goals and fighting the good fight. And, you know, and it usually will work out for you. Not always, but.
Brandon, you know, that's really interesting to hear from someone who didn't start off in education and especially who was a Marine. Thank you for your service, by the way. And to make that comparison to immigrant students, I think it's fantastic to compare the American dream as you just did. I completely agree with you that's patriotism, right? It comes in many forms. And when I watch them overcome their own obstacles and do the best they possibly can, that's just about as an American dream as you can get. One of the things that students ask a lot, especially the curious students, ask, well, what do you think, right? What do you think, Mr. Johnson? What do you think, Mr. Valenzuela? When it comes to politics, when students ask, I answer them. I'm a lifelong liberal. I have been a member of the Democratic Party for some time. I'm disappointed with them recently. I try to make sure we present both sides. But when they ask me a personal question, I certainly answer, especially when it comes to things like immigration and what we're going to do with DACA and what we're going to do with our DREAM Act, because those are my students. Those are the faces I see every day.
I kind of have an interesting position teaching in Oakland. And it started a while ago because in Oakland, we try to have both sides of every issue. It's kind of like a district mandate. When you have a guest speaker, you need to have somebody. And being that most teachers didn't know any other conservatives, I became the token counter guy. I'm a conservative, right? I explained to them why I voted the way I did. And yes, I voted for Trump. Not that I am a Trump fan.
If I can ask, how do you feel now? I mean, you obviously deal with students who are undocumented. You've heard the comments, of course, from President Trump. We're still waiting to find out what his policies are on DACA. I know in my classroom, my students who fall under that and my dreamers, they're worried. They're worried every single day.
I understand what you're saying. I just look at the pragmatics. There's no way you're going to throw 15 million people out of a country.
I agree with you.
We can't continue this with this large group of people, whether Latino or Asians, you know, undocumented. It's this is insanity, and it's totally against everything I believe. And I think what our founding fathers would have believed in is, you know, it's like slavery in a different form.
I agree 100%. You know what I find curious though is being a conservative. Do you have an opinion or have you thought about why do you think that members of Congress, that Republican members of Congress, have not come out as passionately as you are about this subject?
I think, to be honest, I'm totally disappointed with both parties. It used to be the Democrats' parties were social justice and helping the poor man and jobs and unions. Where has that gone? Look at the systems that have established. In the Republican Party, it's the money for grab. They're both the same, and hence the outsiders. You like Bernie, I like Trump. I think there needs to be a house cleaning.
It may be cliche for a teacher, but I'll tell you, every day I have a student comes in and they ask a question about something going on in the headlines. What does this mean? How do I find out more about that? And then it leads to another question and another question. And that's education, right? You talk about a teachable moment. Every day these days is a teachable moment for our students. And I think the curiosity and the need to know and to grow, that's very hopeful to see in students.
Nice meeting you, Cedro.
Brandon, nice meeting you. It sounds like we're on the same track, buddy. Maybe me and you get together, do a little fishing.
I fish like crazy. I'm from Idaho.
Oh, heck. Let's do it.
Take care.
To check out more dialogues between Californians in our series Start the Conversation, visit californiareport.org and send us your ideas for conversations you'd like to hear or be a part of at calreport@kqed.org. Whether we're teachers, software engineers, or chefs, many of us end up in our careers in unexpected ways. Today, we're going to hear a story about how civil rights attorney Robert Rubin went from teaching people with disabilities to becoming a lawyer. He's played a role in major legal battles that have helped shape our state with a nearly perfect track record when it comes to winning cases. Reporter Parth Shah takes us back in time to meet a younger Robert Rubin. Our story begins 3,000 miles away from California.
Robert Rubin thought he landed the perfect first job after graduating college.
I was planning on working in the mental health field.
It was 1973. He was a teacher at a school in upstate New York for the developmentally disabled. But soon after he started,
I discovered that the administrators of the school that I was teaching at were using psychotropic drugs to medicate and discipline these students who are adults with developmental disabilities, and they're using a cattle prod, an electrical cattle prod, as behavior punishments.
Rubin reported the abuse to the ACLU.
Long before I knew what the word was, I was a whistleblower.
Soon, Rubin found himself in a courtroom, testifying in the witness stand against the school. Sitting in the hot seat, Rubin had a revelation.
The lights went off and the gong sounded, and there I was. I had my path carved out for me.
The next step on that path, law school.
Yeah, I wasn't interested in being a lawyer so much. What I was interested in was promoting social change.
So he got his law degree and called the ACLU again, this time for a job. They hired Rubin and sent him to Jackson, Mississippi.
I was the sole attorney for the ACLU for the state of Mississippi in 1979. And it was an incredible experience.
Incredible because as a rookie lawyer, he got to give oral arguments in the Federal Court of Appeals. He was taking on First Amendment, jail conditions, and police misconduct cases. But he worked in courts where the presiding judge was endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan. During his 2 years in Jackson, Rubin saw people and even the press fearlessly revealed their racism.
Well, I woke up on Sunday morning and, as usual, got the Sunday paper and got back into bed to read it. And I'm flipping through it. And
he stops on a political cartoon. It's a picture of what looks like terrorists being defended by a snooty lawyer.
Wait a minute. That's got to be me. And I never had seen a caricature of myself. But I trust I don't quite look as extreme as this person with a nose that goes halfway across the page. But it was clearly intended to depict someone who was Jewish.
The cartoon is from July 6, 1980. Rubin was defending a group of Iranian college students in Mississippi who were facing deportation because of the Iran hostage crisis. A year later, Rubin moved to San Francisco, and he brought that political cartoon with him. It now hangs in his office.
Why do you keep this up next to your desk?
Well, because I think it's a reminder that at times of crisis, we tend to clamp down on civil rights.
There are plenty of other reminders here at the law offices of Robert Rubin. It actually feels less like a law firm and more like a teeny studio apartment. Photo frames cover an exposed brick wall. They memorialize his work helping Haitian refugees, advocating for Muslims in the wake of 9/11, and one of his most celebrated victories. Let's go back to 1994, when this advertisement was all over television.
They keep coming. 2 million illegal immigrants in California. The federal government won't stop them.
Governor Pete Wilson's re-election campaign was all about enforcing Prop 187, a law that would ban undocumented people from using public services in the state.
Enough is enough.
Governor Pete Wilson.
Wilson was re-elected, and California voters overwhelmingly passed Prop 187, but it never went into effect. Robert Rubin was one of the lawyers who challenged the law in court, where it was found unconstitutional and ultimately overturned. The next day, Rubin was interviewed on KQED's call-in radio show, hosted by Michael Krasny.
There's tremendous outrage. The sense is, this is a mandate. We voted this in. Mm-hmm. We citizens deserve to have carried out in law the initiative that we passed. What do you say to the people who feel that way?
Certain branches of our government do respond to the popular will. Our executive branch, our legislative branch, but our court system, our judiciary, does not bend to the popular will.
Nearly 25 years later, Rubin is still explaining this civics lesson.
The Bill of Rights, the Equal Protection Clause in particular, is specifically geared to essentially thwart the majority will, because the majority oftentimes acts in unconstitutional ways.
It's not just time that's worn down Robert Rubin's voice. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease more than a decade ago. He's self-conscious about the way he sounds, but he says his Parkinson's helps him empathize more with the clients he represents. Rubin turned 65 last year. If you asked him at his birthday party where life was taking him next, he would have said retirement.
But with the way the election turned out and the way this president has seen fit to trample on civil rights and civil liberties, it just seemed like I couldn't abandon my colleagues on the front lines.
So Robert Rubin is now devoting his work to enforcing the California Voting Rights Act. It's a law that requires cities with sizable minority populations to vote by district, to make local government better reflect the people. So far, he's sued a dozen cities, all pro bono. He's currently challenging Santa Clara and Santa Monica. And Rubin has yet to lose a case. For the California Report, I'm Parth Shah.
Anybody in the California mariachi music scene, and they'll know the Morales family from the Central Valley town of Delano. Juan Morales played with mariachi superstars Los Camperos, and his daughters played at Carnegie Hall earlier this year with the group Mariachi Mestizo. Now, one member of the family is exploring another art form. Teenager Xochitl Morales is about to release her first album. And it's not mariachi music. It's poetry, spoken word. The California Report's Central Valley reporter Vanessa Rancaño brings us this profile.
We're at my family's music studio right now.
17-year-old Xochitl Morales has been surrounded by music since she was in the womb. It's still a huge part of her life.
Yeah, it's eat, breathe, sleep, mariachi.
She plays just about every instrument in the mariachi, and today she's giving a violin lesson to 3-year-old Damien.
What do we do with the dots here?
Put our fingers right there, and then right there.
There you go. Now play Mississippi Hot Dog.
While her days are filled with music, she spends her nights writing poetry.
My first language was Spanish. Learned from sweet stories told by my papi at bedtime.
In this YouTube video, she sports perfectly drawn black eyeliner, braces, and a t-shirt that says, Poet. Xochitl stands against a white backdrop, looking straight into the camera. The video, produced by BuzzFeed last year, has over 80,000 views and got Xochitl's poetry major media attention for the first time. She'd shared the spotlight before, as part of Mariachi Mestizo, the youth group her dad started. They recorded an album with Little Village Foundation, a nonprofit run by musician Jim Pugh. But Pugh was also interested in releasing her poetry.
It was just this, like, explosion of improvisation.
In 2 days, she wrote the 11 poems on her album, Descansos. She also improvised music for the record with her dad. Her favorite is the first poem on the album. It's about the place she grew up.
It's the Central Valley talking to me, kind of telling me, like, hey, as much as you don't want to be here, this is home.
children of narco refugees and lipstick stains, Chavez boycott babies, cheeks of neighborhood cholos. All of you were made in this valley, in this belly of deadly blossoms, of eyes that saw and left the motherland, born in this body of bloody endings and proud father tears on graduation days. Yes, including you, girl who wishes on my stars for city lights against midnight. You cannot deny that I run through your blood.
Xochitl has come to embrace the Central Valley as part of her artistic identity. She writes a lot about the region's agriculture industry and its workers. The first poem she ever wrote and performed was about pesticides.
I went to go talk about pesticide poisoning to a bunch of urban kids from LA, and they were like, whoa, this happens?
As a kid, she remembers being told she couldn't go out to recess because nearby fields had been crop dusted. It's a theme she returns to on her album.
I know what this means for those that have a choice. No walks for a week, windows closed while we sleep. This means sticky nights and no recess for the schools across the street.
For Xochitl, art and activism are intertwined. She says what's most important about her art is that it have impact. She wants to move to New York City for college, maybe to study art and politics. She knows that could be risky.
Now, and I really want someone to validate that this is what I should be doing, because, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on second-generation Americans to kind of go into jobs that are guaranteed, like, a stable income.
We've been there, done that.
That's her mom, Leticia. Even though she and her husband, Juan, have dedicated themselves to music, they're conflicted about the path Xochitl wants to pursue.
When we first married, we just lived off of, you know, the music, and it was hard.
It's a tough way to live.
We want them to have something better than our struggles.
But Xochitl's already started down that path, and her parents helped put her on it.
I was named after a war goddess, Xochitl, Toltec queen leading a battalion of women to arms. Xochitl, southern fireball that found breath in sister and mother.
Xochitl is still figuring out who she is as an artist, so the future is uncertain. But she says she won't put her pen or her instruments down for long. For the California Report, I'm Vanessa Rancagno in Delano.
And that's our show for this week. The California Report magazine is a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Is there a good California story where you live? Let us know on Facebook or email us at calreport@kqed.org. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Katie McMurrin. Our editorial team includes Victoria Maulion, Susie Racho, Ryan Levy, Bianca Taylor, Lacey Jane Roberts, David Marks, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from Barracuda Networks. Cloud-ready firewalls engineered for today's next-generation business networks. Learn more at barracuda.com/cloud-ready. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.